We're going to call the State Government Finance Committee meeting to order. Representative Schultz, are you interested in moving the minutes?
Sure, I move the minutes from April 6th.
Representative Schultz moves the minutes for April 6th, 2016. Are there any corrections? Seeing no corrections, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes for April 6th, 2016 are adopted. Representative Pugh, we're going to start off with you. We have House File 2868. Representative Pugh moves House File 2868 to be referred to the Committee on Tax. Representative Pugh, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I'm so excited about this bill. Thank you for hearing it today. And I absolutely believe that you will be too. So as you can see, I have several testifiers here with me who you'll hear from shortly. Members, I'm not sure who has learned more throughout this process, the students of Concordia University or me as a second-term state representative. It was early in February when I received an email from one of the students, Joshua Coyne, who informed me that Concordia was one of Minnesota's yellow ribbon schools, and that his political science class, which included a number of veterans, had an idea for a bill that they'd like to discuss. They'd researched legislative members, were looking for one that was who was passionate about veterans and about students, and they informed me that they had selected me. So I just can't tell you how really excited and honored I was to get to work on behalf of these students, and the experience has been amazing. Also, the support that I've received in navigating the process from those with far more expertise than I has also been fantastic. I'd like to acknowledge specifically Veterans Division Chairman Detmer for his assistance, Ben Johnson of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, I don't know if Ben is here this morning, and Jeff Diebel of our House Research, who have been just all, and all of those gentlemen are veterans themselves, not to mention Senator Bruce Anderson, who's also a veteran who's carrying the bill in the Senate. The students presented their idea at the monthly military action group, which is referred to as MAG, in February. They received a tremendous amount of support, of interest and encouragement from those in attendance, and continue to do their work right up to and through their spring break at Concordia. Our first draft revisions included working to tweak the thresholds for the State Soldiers Assistance Program, referred to as SSAP, making it more accessible to veterans like Hank, who is not with us today, one of the students. One of the initial drafts included an appropriation of $2 million as well. However, the realities of a short session, it not being a budget year, and the fact that tweaking an established program like SSAP, which grants benefits to dependents and veterans in housing, optical, education, hearing aids, and more, all in addition to dental, was simply not simple or realistic this session. So that resulted in us taking our bill in a different direction. So we amended our bill in the Veterans Division, completely removing any reference to SSAP and also removing the appropriation. But we added language to create a provision for charity care so that any of the over 4,000 dental providers in the state of Minnesota who are willing to provide dental services either free or at a reduced charge, of which I believe there will be many, two veterans will receive a tax credit, technically a subtraction, for doing so. And the program will be managed through our really established and terrific Veterans Service Officers programs, which are active in all 87 counties. So, members, that in essence is my bill, and as you can see, what everybody's been waiting for is to hear from the students. So I'll let them introduce themselves and talk a little bit more specifically about the bill.
Welcome. If you can please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I am Ryan Olson.
Thank you for the privilege of testifying today on House File 2868, which was heard with zero opposition last week before the House Veterans Affairs Division and twice before the Senate committees. I'm incredibly proud of this bill. Thank you, Chairwoman, and you for your co-authoring. As students for over this last 6 months, we have researched every possible angle to find a solution to emergency dental care for veterans, especially student veterans, after knowing what happened to our classmate, Marine veteran Hank Goff. Hank had a job interview this morning and was unable to attend the meeting.
My name is Jacob Davis, and I'm here to tell you the story of our classmate and teammate, Hank Goff. Hank is a recent veteran after serving 4 years with the U.S. Marine Corps and was just the recipient of the Disney Spirit Sport Award on ESPN. Today we are discussing our legislative proposal to revitalize access to the Minnesota State Assistance Program, in particular to ensuring veterans to have access to emergency dental care. When Hank was serving on a Navy's float in 2010, he received dental care for a simple fill-in. Hank received an honorable discharge and enrolled in Concordia University. This November, that same tooth decayed and rotted out due to insufficient military dental care, and Hank, while in our classroom, suddenly found himself with a massive infection and needed immediate medical procedures. Unknown to us all, only if a veteran is 100% service disabled can they receive any dental care. Instead, Hank found himself visiting the dentist and being told he had two options: pay out of pocket $6,000 or have his tooth pulled for $1,000. As a full-time student athlete, you can imagine his checkbook. After a week of pain, Hank's options were limited and he had to have the tooth pulled and face the $1,000 bill. He told our professor about the class experience and the lack of dental care.
I'm Rich Kelly and I'm another teammate of Hank's. Here's today's good news, though. Me and my classmates have spent the last 5 months researching other dental programs, Minnesota's current veterans options, and we have discovered an easy fix that would open up access for Minnesota State Soldier Assistance Plan to all veterans past, present, and future. Minnesota service members and veterans have two chances to receive dental benefits through various programs already established. The first being they automatically get dental benefits if they have 100% disability rating, or secondly through the MSSAP. Currently, that program is funded at $5.6 million, but is not just for dental care. It offers a limited dental coverage by three possible programs with a voucher up to $3,000 a year, but has very restrictive eligibility thresholds. Basically, if you make more than $1,300 a month or you have $3,000 in assets, you cannot be a part of it.
Take Hank's situation. Here we have a college veteran who gave our country his unbelievable leadership and service. Busting to make ends meet and his financial aid, loans, grants, and scholarships immediately make him ineligible for this program. According to Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, in 2014, Minnesota has over 369,000 veterans, including 15,000 student veterans, like my two classmates. It appears our pilot program could help approximately between 15,000 and 184,500 Minnesota veterans who cannot qualify for our pilot program. Instead, we are going to propose a tax subtraction that will help our students get the dental care that they need.
The willingness of Minnesota veterans to sacrifice for our country has earned our lasting gratitude. We would like to thank Representative Pugh and Senator Addison for being our co-chief authors and working with us to find a reasonable solution to this easy fix. Our legislation does 3 points. Requires the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs to identify dental professionals who are willing to provide free or reduced fee dental service to veterans. Requires the Commissioner to make these providers aware of the tax subtraction in Section 2. Creates a tax subtraction for the dental health care providers who provide free dental care discounted to the veterans, and makes a conforming change to the alternative minimum tax statute that reflects to the tax subtraction in Section 2. Thank you, Mrs. Chairwoman. It's time to give the veterans the benefits they deserve. We are ready for any questions.
Thank you, gentlemen. Great teammates that Hank has, so very fortunate. Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to speak to this bill? Members, any questions? Okay. And then we do have comment. Mr. Shepard, we have to adopt this as a division report, you said?
Yes, Madam Chair, when this bill was introduced, it was referred to the State Government Finance Committee, and then you referred it to division. The division referred it back with a division report that's in the members' packets.
Okay, very good. So we have that before us. I don't see any member questions at this time, so Representative Pugh is going to move that we adopt this as a division report. And then do we first adopt that and then we move the bill? Is that what we need to do next, Mr. Shepard? Okay. So the first motion is going to be adopting the division's report on House File 2868. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? So the division report has been adopted. Now we're on to the bill. Representative Pugh's motion to move this to Tax Committee next. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? Welcome. Congratulations, guys. This is going to taxes next. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
All right. Okay, Representative Wills. Representative Wills, we're just discussing to make sure that we put this in the right place. So they've already had it. We're going to move this to, I think what we're going to do is we're going to move this to the general register because I know your costs are covered, and so it shouldn't be an issue of ways and means. I'm sure Representative Carlson will chime in if you have concerns on it. But that's what we're going to start off with. The motion is House File 2825 going to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
My understanding of looking at the bill and actually looking at it from a government operations perspective, might I suggest that the next step would be for us to take this to GovOps before we take it to the General Register?
Well, we'll have a discussion on that in a little bit. Let's have Representative Wills proceed with her bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. House File 2825 makes changes to the Manufactured Homes Trust Fund. The changes are pretty straightforward in the bill. You'll see that the increases are on the first page from $4,000 to $7,000 for a single section and from $8,000 to $12,500 for a multi-section manufactured home. And then on page 3, we also included language, if the appraised market value cannot be determined, the tax market value averaged over a period of 5 years can be used as a substitute. And also the maximum amount that can be reimbursed instead of $5,000 is now $8,000 for a single section, and instead of $9,000 is now $14,500 for a multi-section, and then guaranteeing a minimum amount of $4,000 for a single section and $8,000 for a multi-section manufactured home. And then on the fourth page, we included a study to look at alternative ways that the fee could be collected from homeowners. Right now, the fund is completely funded through fees assessed to the homeowners of $12 per year. And right now, the park owners are collecting that on behalf of MMB, and we're looking at a more efficient, hopefully a more efficient way to do that. And so that's the purpose of the study. And the study itself is funded out of the trust fund, and so there's no tax dollars involved in the fund or in the bill. So I have a few testifiers here today who can explain a little bit more about the trust fund and the reasons for making these increases and just the personal experience as well of why this would be beneficial to the residents.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Dave Anderson. I'm executive director of All Parks Lines for Change, which is a statewide association of manufactured homeowners. Madam Chair, members of the committee, to provide some background information, the Manufactured Home Relocation Trust Fund is a program administered by the state but funded by $12 annual contributions from manufactured homeowners, also known as mobile homeowners. The program does not use any taxpayer funds, and nothing that we're suggesting in this proposal would use any taxpayer funds. The fund covers 180,000 Minnesotans who own their homes but rent the land underneath those homes. The program covers moving costs or replacement costs in the event of private redevelopment. If there's public redevelopment, other programs exist to cover those relocation costs. The program is necessary to cover the moving costs because 80% of the owners of these homes are low to very low income based on HUD guidelines. Unfortunately, although the program has worked well, there's no mechanism for the benefits to increase over time, so they've been the same since 2007 when the program was created. And this is despite the fact that, based on the estimates we've been able to collect, the lowest estimates for moving we were able to collect exceeded the maximum amount you could receive to move your home. And that was the case for both single-section homes and multi-section homes. And the fund can easily support the increase. The most paid out in benefits in a single year was $81,000. The average amount paid out is $31,000. By comparison, the amount that's collected with one annual collection of the $12 fee is $350,000, which is four times the greatest amount paid out in a year and 11 times the average amount paid out in a year. So it's certainly, and as a result, the balance has never been below $1 million in the last 6 years. So it should easily be able to afford the changes in benefits.
Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jackie DeVore. I'm a manufactured home owner, and I live in Arden Manor Mobile Home Park in Arden Hills. Our park is bordered on the west by 35W, north by Highway 10, and on the south by County Road 96, and on the other side we've got the Twin Cities Armory Ammunition Plant, also known as TCAP. For the last 8 years, we've faced many development threats, including proposals to expand the highway and to put a stadium for the Vikings on the TCAP site. I live on what I receive each month from Social Security. Without the Manufactured Home Relocation Trust Fund, I could not afford to have my home moved if necessary if the park closed. Unfortunately, the maximum benefits available to move my home is still thousands of dollars short of what it would actually cost. I'm not alone in facing this problem. Most other park residents who also live in our park are low income or fixed income, including 285 households. Residents created the Manufactured Home Relocation Trust Fund with our annual $12 fee. This is money that we, the homeowners, paid in. When we need it, we expect the fund to help us to move our homes so we are not forced to just abandon them. I'm very grateful to Representative Anna Wells for authoring the House File 2825, which increases the benefits paid so that we actually will match the cost of moving our homes. I strongly urge support for it. Thank you, Chair and Committee.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to speak to this bill? If you do, please come forward. And if you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
My name is Denise Brisher. I live in Beaver Lake Estates in Maplewood, which is just about 2 miles north of 3M. I've lived there for 5 years, and I have undergone the experience of moving my home. Not because the park is going to close, but I couldn't get along with my neighbors. It cost $8,000 to move a new model single-wide home one block. The current reimbursement allowance for moving homes is way too low and is sadly in need of updating. Thank you very much for your time, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you for your testimony. Member, are there any questions? Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. The this would be for Mr. Anderson, I guess, on page 3, line 10. And now we're talking about a provision where they wouldn't get paid to move the mobile home but would actually have the mobile home purchased from them?
Mr. Anderson.
Correct.
The
Representative Lunan.
On line 10, it says that the minimum amount that may be reimbursed under the fund is $4,000. So regardless of what the value, the actual value of the mobile home would be, the check they would get would be no smaller than $4,000. Is that correct?
Mr. Anderson.
That is correct. Currently, it's whatever the assessed or appraised value is, even if the assessed or appraised value is zero. But this would allow some benefit if a person was forced to abandon their home due to a redevelopment.
Representative Lewin. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is probably for Mr. Anderson, maybe for the author. But I'm looking at the changes in the bill itself, and I noticed that they all regard to the reimbursement. I'm just wondering why there isn't a commensurate pay-in change as well as the pay-out. You could just maybe...
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Albright. I appreciate that question, and it's a good question. And part of the reason why we're not addressing the annual fee is because the annual fee is sufficient to cover any costs that have incurred over the previous several years. If you notice on the handout with the spreadsheet with the fiscal years 2008 through fiscal years 2015, you'll see that the highest payout was after the housing crisis in 2008, in the year 2009, and it was a little over $82,000. And if you look at the bottom line, you can see the remaining balance. So even with the highest payout at the $12 annual fee collected, there's still a high balance remaining. So at this time, we don't see a justification to increase that fee.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow on then, just curious in terms of how many park closures have we actually experienced over the course of the last, say, 5 to 10 years? And I'm just wondering in terms of from that perspective, how many claims might have been assessed against this fund or account?
Mr. Anderson or Representative Wills?
Yes. I wish I'd sat down with a list of the closures in front of me, but it certainly hasn't been more in the last 10 years than 10 or 12.
Representative Albright.
No further. Thank you.
Representative Howell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I've got one question for the for Representative Wills and one for Mr. Anderson. But when does the one question I guess I'll ask Mr. Anderson first is looking at lines 3.6 and 3.11, where does that money come from? Does that come out of the trust fund, or does that come up out of the manufactured home? Who pays for that if the home cannot be, is in such a state that it can't be relocated, or is in such a dilapidated state that you can't move it, and this is a minimum payment? Who pays that? Does that come out of the fund, or does that come out of the manufactured home park owner?
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Powell. Thank you for the question. And that comes out of the trust fund as well. And part of the reason why you would have a payout to an individual who's paid in the $12 a year, even if the home is valued below the payout amount, is because if they're forced out of their home, they didn't have a choice in the matter. But putting in that $12 fee is like an insurance for them. So it's all funded out of the trust fund.
Representative Howe.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. having just experiencing going through one of these right now in the jurisdiction that I work in, I don't, Mr. Anderson, that's true. That fee to buy those homes comes out of the fund. I thought the whoever owned the park had to pay that fee.
Mr. Anderson.
All payments are processed through the Relocation Trust Fund. The Relocation Trust Fund is funded by an annual $12 homeowner fee. And at the time of closure, the park owner who owns or the developer who's bought the community pays in a one-time per home fee. They also are able to collect a per home credit towards the demolition of any homes that they purchased as a result of them not being movable.
Representative Howe.
And those fees are addressed here, or are they increased in this bill?
Mr. Anderson.
Those payments are not changed at all. So the one-time fee paid by the community owner is not increased. The only changes are to the benefit amounts that are being paid out. Those are the only dollar changes.
And the fee that they pay is what today?
It's $3,250 per single section or single wide, and $6,000 per double wide.
Okay, one more question.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then, what is the effective date of this legislation?
Representative Wills.
Madam Chair. I do not see an effective date in the language.
Mr. Shepard?
I would assume upon passage.
Madam Chair and members, when there's no effective date specified in a bill that doesn't have an appropriation, the effective date is August 1st. This one bill does have an appropriation to MMB in it, and so I think the effective date would be July 1st of 2016.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to know a little bit more about the flow of the process, and so I'm wondering if anyone can explain to me, and maybe this is from the testifier or someone in the audience that might be able to assist me in terms of understanding how the money gets into the fund.
Mr. Anderson.
Yes. So the money that goes into and remains in the fund and is maintained and has its balances reported on annually are collected as a result of MMB on an annual basis looks at the balance of the fund, whether it's above or below $1 million. In either case, they send out a notice to the community owners informing them that either there will or will not be a collection of the $12 fee that year. If there is a collection, notices go to the park owners. The park owners calculate the number of homeowner-occupied lots. They pay in that amount times $12 and then are able to pass along the cost either as a one-time $12 fee or as a $1 per month increase in the fee. So that's how the money that goes into the relocation trust fund that sits there and is reported on as a balance takes place. In the case of the one-time fees that are collected, that would be processed through the closure process that is overseen by a neutral third party appointed by the local jurisdiction that's overseeing the closure process. And paid for out of the trust fund.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, I think we have someone who also wants to speak to this issue.
Welcome. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mark Bruner, and I represent the Manufactured Modular Home Association of Minnesota. We're the organization that represents the owners of manufactured home communities as well as the builders and sales centers. And just briefly to Representative Albright's question in terms of how this is funded, Mr. Anderson explained that there is this process of the state of Minnesota sending out an invoice, to the owner of the manufactured home park for an amount equal to the number of licensed home sites. What's really sort of interesting is this process has changed significantly the past few years, not by our initiation, but when we agreed and supported the legislation in 2007, it was developed as an insurance policy type program, if you will. If the owner of a manufactured home paid into the fund and the their community were to close, then they would be reimbursed. And I believe it was the 2009-2010 session, Mr. Anderson's organization introduced legislation that completely changed that, which we did not support. And so what we have today is the current system where the owner of the manufactured home park is invoiced, has to write a check out to the state. They are able to collect the $12 from their residents if they want to assess them a one-time fee for $12, include it in the rent, that kind of thing. However, there's really no recourse if someone doesn't pay, and this issue came up in the Senate last week, and we're working in that body to resolve the issue. But essentially, the only way that the owner of a manufactured home community can collect their $12 from someone who doesn't pay is to evict them. And you know, that really doesn't make sense economically. If somebody's paying $400 a month in rent for their home site, to hire an attorney and evict them over $12, so that doesn't happen. Essentially, then we're on the hook for making that payment. The good news is, you know, last year, according to the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, there were only six claims. Under the current system that's in place for collection, there hasn't been a collection by MMB, and I think it's been like 5 years. I mean, this fund just isn't used all that much, so it's sort of the urgency to do something about it, really isn't there. So we do have concerns relative to the study. I mean, the program that's in place right now was put in place by Mr. Anderson's organization. Over the years, we've had proposals to come up with other options, and one of them was that the Department of Revenue include on personal property tax statements, manufactured homes that are on leased land are taxed as personal property. Manufactured homes that are cited as real property on real estate, which is about 80% of our homes, are taxed as a regular home. So the idea was that on the property tax statement, you'd put this $12 that would be assessed. It sounded like a good idea. If somebody didn't pay, then the Department of Revenue could use its recapture authority to go after the money. And they really opposed that for any organization or any entity to put some amount on a tax statement, just because doing it for us would open the door for other organizations, whether it's, sports or whatever, to put some type of fee on property taxes. So that was a non-starter. So we've been down that path. We originally had the program where the residents were invoiced or charged directly. We're now at where the owner of the manufactured home park is assessed. So I'm not really sure where a study would go with this program or why that would be necessary. So our biggest concern right now is just with the collection and the inability to take any type of action if someone doesn't pay. So it's really a burden that we absorb right now.
And Mr. Bruner, let me ask you this. When somebody has a home, do they have to pay a deposit at all to have their home on that site?
Well, there is a security deposit that's paid in most cases. It's limited to what it can be, so that if someone doesn't pay their rent and they're evicted, that then you could keep their security, or if they damage the property.
And Mr. Bruner, is it limited by the arrangement that you have as an individual owner, or is it limited by state law on collecting that as part of the deposit that you have to make?
That's limited by statute in terms of what actually you can withhold the security deposit for.
So it is possible that as part of the MMB study, they might make a recommendation to make the change that you could put that as part of the deposit and that you would be able to collect the $12 there.
Well, I mean, that would be, you know, one possibility, you know, but of course you wouldn't be able to collect until somebody moved out.
Okay. All right. Well, we appreciate that. Members, any other questions? So, Representative Will, here is the situation. We have Representative Carlson here who represents the Ways and Means Committee. We have Representative Nelson here who represents the GovOps Committee. I have members that are telling me that GovOps will most likely want this bill. So we could send it to the General Register, but you might be faced with a situation where the chair of the GovOps Committee will ask for it to come back. So and Representative Nelson probably has a comment to that effect.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess looking at this as a former chair of the GovOps, I don't see a mandatory referral to GovOps. I mean, it might have been wise to have it go there at the beginning, but right now if we send it to GovOps, we're basically killing it, unless they go, and then it would have to go through rules. But there's really nothing in here that, you know, it's not spending money out of the state coffers, it's spending money out of this trust fund. And the study does not make it a mandatory referral to GovOps, so I don't see why it's, you know, why it has to go there in my mind. So, Madam Chair.
With that, I'm for now going to be sending it to the General Register, Representative Wills. I don't see, it does not cost the state any money, so I don't see it needing to go to Ways and Means. So I'm going to renew my motion that House File 2825 be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? There we go. We're sending 2825 to the General Register.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Wills. Representative Petersburg. And Representative Petersburg moves House File 2270 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I believe there is a DE4 amendment that I thought was handed out, but I think there are copies coming around. And just briefly, what the amendment does is it refers to some of the information at the last meeting, some concerns about from the Historical Society as well as the CAP Board in regards to exactly how everything runs. It was just some minor changes with that, and it also takes out the appropriations from this, and just requires the Commissioner of Administration to do this. And so I would like to move the DE4 amendment as well.
And you know what? This changes then to where it goes. I think that it should be able to go to the General Register after that then too.
Okay. I appreciate that.
Do I have to refer it to both? Okay, so it has to go to rules because it concerns the capital, and so that's where we're going to move it. So, Representative Petersburg, you're going to move House File 2270 to go to rules. We have the DE4 that you've moved that's before us right now. Members, are there any questions? You don't have it yet? Oh, it's coming. And while it's coming around, just explain again that this takes out the financial component to it.
Correct. With the targets and so forth, I think the funding for it right now is problematic. I know the CAP Board and Historical Society, I've chatted with them. They're going to do their yeoman's job of trying to find some funds within some discretionary funding as well. This is a small item, and as you see the fiscal note, it was about $15,000 in the original bill. Talking to the CAP Board, they thought maybe $10,000 was more appropriate, so we'll see where this goes, but at this juncture the bill would have no appropriation in it for the plaque.
And members, at this point what I'd like to do is just get the bill in the shape that the author wishes to have it, and then we'll have him present the bill and we'll go from there. Okay. Mm-hmm. So Representative Petersburg moves the DE4 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay, DE4 amendment has been adopted. And Representative Petersburg, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee, for hearing this bill. This bill is probably the most grassroots bill that you could ever find, and nothing more grassroots than sixth graders who worked on a project for their class since they were not allowed to come up to the Capitol for their normal class trips during their sixth grade civics program. They decided to research the Capitol, and I'm not going to talk much about it because I want you to hear it from them, but just suffice it to say that they came to me with a petition, about 70 pages here, in which they put together an opportunity for the public and for people in their community to have input about what's happening here up here at the Capitol and some of the concerns that they have. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn over to my testifiers.
Welcome to the committee.
Grace Linders, Owatonna, Minnesota. On July 27, 1898, marching bands led thousands of people to the highest point in downtown St. Paul, Minnesota. Hundreds of veterans, stonecutters, and other workers marched to the ribbon-draped speaker stand. Here the new Capitol was rising from the ground. Onlookers leaned over the partially finished first floor walls.
Jack Tichenor, Owatonna, Minnesota. Among the many dignitaries was Minnesota's first territorial governor, Alexander Ramsey, to officially lay the cornerstone for the People's House, the grandest building in the state and one of the finest state house buildings in the country.
Greta Corbo, Owatonna, Minnesota. The cornerstone was 5 feet long with a hollow core to hold a copper box. Into the box were placed more than 45 books, newspapers, photos, and documents, including histories of legislators and soldiers since the founding of the state, the names of the Capitol's commissioners and architect Cass Gilbert, as well as his associates, were etched on the bronze plate.
Tiger Jensen, Owatonna, Minnesota. But the box contained not a single name of a worker or contractor who erected the structure. Since construction began in 1896, hundreds of workers were drawn to this spot. They dug and laid the foundation and built the lower walls. Hundreds more came to work there through the building's completion in 1907.
Colin Caff, Owatonna, Minnesota. These people came together to create this Minnesota treasure, but they have remained nameless. It is just time to right this wrong. These workers have waited 119 years to be recognized for their contributions to our state.
Jenna Spatanka, Owatonna, Minnesota. Last year, in Mrs. Hansen's Minnesota Studies class, we helped to organize a letter-writing campaign and obtained more than 700 signatures on a petition in hopes to secure a memorial for these men and women. We sent letters to Minnesota lawmakers to appropriate funds to erect a memorial or plaque in the Minnesota State Capitol, recognizing the efforts of these people, especially those that lost their lives during the construction.
I am here to represent Felix Arthur. Felix Arthur was the first worker to lose his life while building the state capitol. He came north with the controversial white Georgia marble. On May 5, 1898, Felix was working on the stone polishing machine when he got caught in the flywheel and died the next day in St. Joseph's Hospital in St. Paul.
I am here to represent John Biersack. John Biersack, a 36-year-old son of Bavarian immigrants, died in October 1898, a few days after he fell from the derrick.
I'm here to represent Florian Zahner. On August 3, 1900, Florian Zahner, a 40-year-old German-born laborer, fell to his death while wheeling brick and scaffolding to be used in the pediment over Truss No. 1 on the House of Representatives. Florian fell to the ground and was killed. The wheelbarrow ran off the scaffolding, and in trying to keep it from falling, he lost his balance and fell to his death.
I am here to represent Alfred Magnusson. Alfred Magnusson, a 23-year-old Swedish stonemason, also fell to his death in 1900. Magnusson became the fourth death on the job when he fell while setting roof stresses over the Senate chamber.
I am here to represent Albert Svensson. Albert Svensson, a 20-year-old mold caster from Sweden, was killed in a strange accident. A passing wagon drove over a rope used to hoist material and scaffolding on which men stood. The rope pulled the scaffolding down, and Albert Svensson and Frank Thierry both plunged 40 feet. Svensson collided with timbers and died. Thierry landed in a pile of sand and miraculously got away with only a broken leg.
I am here to represent John Corrigan. On June 25th, 1903, John Corrigan, an 18-year-old laborer, fell 32 feet near the Senate chamber. The young man was just a week or two on the job at the state capitol when he fell to his death. John was the last fatal accident to occur at the state capitol building site.
Jen Hansen, Owatonna. I'm here to represent the other 90 students involved with this project that were not able to attend. Their efforts to provide a memorial to honor the men and women who built our state capitol. These students saw the beauty in a structure that was built to stand the test of time. They recognized the skill of the craftsmen, the masons, and the sculptors. In a day and age where young people look at the new and the shiny, they saw the beauty in the old and the marvelous. They recognized the work of the men and women from 119 years ago, and they wanted to recognize their contributions to the great state of Minnesota. We hope that you will support House File 2270 and help us to recognize those men and women who built our state capitol, who are long gone, but to whom we will be forever grateful. Thank you.
In closing, basically, in talking with the class, we wanted to have something that could be shared by all of the students, sixth graders, throughout the state, and that's the reason for the contest, in which they then have the opportunity not only to participate in this, but also to learn more about how a legislature is created and how bills are made. And with that, I commend the students for their actions and for what they want. And with that, we will stand for any questions or concerns that you might have.
And if I could ask the kids, do me one favor. I want to get a photograph of all of you at the testifier table. I have to tell you, this has been the best presentation I have ever seen. And if I can get this has been great this morning. And I'll just tell you a little bit. One, two, three.
Just stay there.
I have to tell you, the Capitol is something that I've been fascinated with since I took my sixth grade class. You know, when you come up to the Capitol and you get to see it. From that moment on, I thought this place really means something because you are impacting the lives of people on a day-to-day basis. And the time and energy that these folks put into building that structure and the detail and thinking about what our state was about is just remarkable. There's so many things to see. I can't wait until it's revealed again in its shining glory and we get to see it how perhaps people saw it when it was first built. So this is wonderful that you guys came forward. I really appreciate you guys taking the trip. I'm sure, what time did you guys have to get up this morning?
Six.
And you'll never forget that, I bet. Yes. That's an early time. So well, I appreciate so much you guys doing this. Members, I don't know if you have any comments. I got Representative Nelson first here. And then
thank you, Madam Chair. And I heard this, you heard this bill in GovOps. And I want to thank Representative Petersburg for bringing it forward. And the amendment comment I made was the workers that did the are doing the remodeling now. Wait a minute, then you've added that to the bill. So it makes a good bill even better. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Kahn.
Representative Anderson, does that mean you're going to sign on my 16-year-old voting bill?
I agree.
When you look at these people and you see how much more fit they are to vote than most of the people who vote for us.
Well, I will tell you this. I do hope that this has inspired you to remain active in the political process because your voice really makes a difference. So really appreciate you coming forward. I don't know if there's anybody from the audience that wishes to speak to this bill at all.
Madam Chairman.
We do have one person, and Representative Kahn, while he's coming up.
Okay. Let me make one helpful comment. I've actually been working with Representative Mullery to raise funding for the Nellie Stone Johnson statue in the Capitol. And it seems to me this one would be even easier to, particularly from the construction unions and so forth. I sent out our Representative Peterson, I'll give you my Nellie Stone Johnson letter, and you can imitate it and do it for this and send it out.
Great idea. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Glenn Olson, North St. Paul. It was my grandma's father-in-law, is the way I think of it, because I knew my grandma, not my grandpa, who ran a crane that laid some of the stone and the block on this building. So just here to represent that there was other people involved. It isn't just the student project here, but others also concerned about this, that we have relatives in the family who were involved in this and have been following this process as well.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Olson. Members, any final comments or questions? Seeing that none, Representative Petersburg renews his motion that House File 2270 be referred to the Committee on Rules. All those as amended.
You got to go to Rules.
Oh, you think it goes to Ways and
I Means? I thought your original motion was Ways and Means, but that's fine. Thank you.
But they took out the funding component. That's why we changed it. So, to Rules. So, House File 2270 to Rules. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The bill moves forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
All right. Representative Runbeck.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Welcome, Representative Runbeck.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move House File 3024. It's a pretty technical bill, not too emotional like the last bill. I'll just say one small word. The Barber Board has done an amazing thing, and they have reduced the cost and the time involved in becoming certified as a barber. So I think we want to applaud them. But I have Thora Fisco, the Executive Director of the Board, and she will describe the bill.
Welcome. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Thora Fisco, the Executive Secretary for the Minnesota Board of Barber Examiners, and that's a very hard act to follow. They did a wonderful job. As stated, much of this bill is technical in nature. It's going to add some definitions, make some technical changes, add clarifying language throughout to make our statutes clear and understandable. Areas of major change include the elimination of a 1,500-hour apprenticeship and second board exam currently required to become a registered barber in Minnesota. Currently, to become a registered barber, an individual attends school for 1,500 hours, that's 9 months, and it includes 281 classroom hours and 1,219 practical hours. And then they take a board examination to become an apprentice barber. Apprentice barbers then complete a supervised apprenticeship under a registered barber prior to taking a second board examination to become a registered barber. Minnesota is one of only six states that continues to require barber school followed by an apprenticeship. The other states are Massachusetts, Nevada, North Carolina, North Dakota, and South Dakota. And Massachusetts and North Dakota are also exploring eliminating their apprentice requirement. Student barbers are taught how to use, maintain, sanitize, and disinfect their tools and equipment used in the barbershop as part of barber school curriculum. The students are taught about preventing the spread of infectious disease in barber school, and Minnesota barbershops are subject to periodic inspections to ensure that these public safety measures are practiced by barbers throughout the state. Over time, it has become increasingly more difficult for apprentice barbers to find placement with registered barbers to complete the apprentice hours required, especially outside the metro area. Young barbers should be encouraged to work in established shops upon graduation to gain experience and learn about barbershop operation. However, public health and safety requirements are and will continue to be taught as part of the school curriculum. We're also seeking the addition of a fifth board member. The Barber Board is a four-member board, and so as you can imagine, we occasionally run into quorum issues and or tie-breaking issues. And the addition of a fifth member would alleviate those concerns. And the board would like to utilize a credentialing agency to assist the board in verifying credentials presented by applicants trained outside of the U.S. It's sometimes very difficult to know if the documents we're receiving from schools and related to experience outside the country are truly, if they're true. And so there are companies out there that make it their business to verify these documents and these schools. And so we would like to take advantage of one of those agencies. We're currently looking at one that's working with 10 other jurisdictions, either in cosmetology and or barbering. So this company has some experience. And the board is also asking for some expedited rulemaking, and that is to facilitate the changes that are going to be required by eliminating the apprenticeship program. Many of our rules will become obsolete, and others will need some technical changes, and we'd like to be able to move forward and do that as part of this process. And so we would like to be able to do the expedited rulemaking to do that. Financially, the cost to the agency for the expedited rulemaking is estimated at approximately $3,000 and will fit within our current budget that we have for the Office of Administrative Hearings. There are some mailings required for contacting barbers, and we'll do that during our regular registration period in mailings that we already do, so there won't be any additional cost for that as well. And our staff can absorb that little extra work in what we're currently doing, so we're not asking for any appropriation for that one-time cost. And a new member is also estimated to be slightly below $3,000, and we will manage that within our current allocation. I know that the fiscal note that you have is from the original version of the bill. It didn't get updated for the House, but there is an updated fiscal note happening for the Senate that will show that these costs will be absorbed. So we're not asking for any additional funding at this time. With that, Madam Chair, I'll take questions.
I think we'll have Ms. Roberts, if you can speak to the fiscal component.
Madam Chair and members, I have requested an updated fiscal note on the House version, but I have a preliminary note from the Senate, and I think the other piece that the committee should be aware of that is that there will be a small amount of new general fund revenue. The board itself is funded through a direct general fund appropriation, and the fees that they collect go into the general fund, and because there will be some additional, the apprentices would be taking examinations now, there's a small amount of new general fund, estimated at about $7,000 for fiscal year 17.
Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to speak to this bill? Members, any comments or questions to this bill? So we're looking at a $7,000 cost from the general fund, or?
Madam Chair, it's actually a gain to the general fund.
Gain to the general fund, okay. All righty. Well, I think originally Representative Runbeck, I was looking to send this to the General Register, but just to be on the safe side, I think that we should probably send it to the Ways and Means Committee with the $7,000 increase, and we'll do it that way. So Representative Runbeck wants to renew her motion that House File 3024 be referred to the Committee on Ways.
Very good.
All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? The bill is going to Ways and Means. All right, thank you.
Thank you,
appreciate
thank
it.
You Madam Chair, members.
Okay, Representative Albright, if you want to start with House File 2915. Albright moves House File 2915.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. House File 2915 would require Minnesota Management and Budget to report to the legislature yearly on the state's use of federal funds. In addition to getting a clearer understanding of how much federal money Minnesota government spends, legislators and the public would have a better idea in terms of how much state money is used to draw federal funds through a match or maintenance of effort. The state, as we all know, spends billions of dollars across all budget areas, and many times that money comes with strings attached or necessitates additional employees. Gaining a clear understanding on a yearly basis of how those financial relationships correspond between the state and the federal government will allow legislators to make more informed decisions about how to prioritize our own budget. Most of the information that would be required to be included in this federal funds report is available across various sources at the state, and compiling them all together in one clear report, I believe, will help the cause of creating a more transparent budget. We have had conversations with Director Kelly on this matter, and we look forward to continuing those to make sure that we provide a concise and succinct report that would be meaningful to the committees that would appreciate using it going forward. I'm happy to stand for questions.
Okay. Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to speak to this bill? Welcome. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Margaret Kelly. I'm the State Budget Director with Minnesota Management and Budget. And as Representative Albright mentioned, Minnesota Management and Budget currently compiles this information for the biennial budget document. And we provide it along with the governor's biennial budget. It's state agencies that provide the information, and we simply transmit it. So the work of compiling this every other year is already being done by state agencies. We would ask them simply to do it every year, and we would then transmit that to you. And we have started talking with Representative Albright on some technical amendments to make this report, the timing of the delivery of this report, coincide with current information that's already being transmitted to the legislature. But I would just also add that this is a manual process right now, and we would be able to do this without additional cost if we continue to do it as a manual process. To the extent that the legislature or the author wants an electronic database, then we would need to work with Minute to determine how we could modify our current systems to collect that information.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Kelly. What I'm hearing is we're doing this already. We're doing this as part of the annual or the biennial budget. Do these numbers change from year to year? Are we going to get additional information or additional wisdom out of doing it yearly as opposed to doing it as we currently are with the biennial budget? Because if we're doing it already, I don't see, like I said, the addition, and we're doing it already, it's part of the budget documents, you know, I don't see we're gaining a whole lot of extra value out of doing it every year.
Ms. Callahan?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson there. So in the biennial budget, we anticipate what federal grants agencies will receive, as well as federal grants that agencies are currently receiving. So to the extent that agencies receive additional federal grants on an annual basis, those would not be reflected in the report until the next biennial budget. We do transmit that information to the legislature in the form of a federal funds policy request for the LAC once every session. But it's in a little different format. So,
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess then what we're doing is just doing it slightly different. It sounds like we're already doing most of what this bill's asking for, other than if they want it electronically, we're going to cost more money. We're going to have to come up with some sort of reporting form to do it electronically. It sounds like you're doing this currently already manually.
Ms. Callahan.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that's correct.
Any other questions, members? Seeing none, Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 2915 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay.
And then, Representative Albright, we're going to keep you up there, and you've got House File 2104. And members, I do believe this is the. We do have a. Representative Albright, you do have an amendment to this one, don't you?
Madam Chair, I think in light of the fiscal note that you may be looking at, I think it would be more pertinent if we added the author's amendment prior to discussing the bill.
Okay, and so that's the DE1, correct?
Correct, Madam Chair.
So Representative Albright moves the DE1 amendment. Members, you all see that in your packets, right? And to the amendment, can you just briefly describe it before we get this bill in the order of, that you wish?
Madam Chair, a couple of weeks ago, we amended on the contents of 2104 to 2467. And so in light of some other procedural deadlines that were recognized, we thought it appropriate to delete all from 2104 and embrace the efforts of both Representatives Drazkowski and Wagenius in the bill that they put forward. And so we're using 2104 as a mechanism to bring their initiative forward. And so the DE actually recognizes the work that they put together in terms of modifying the forward-looking SAC charges. that are impacting a number of businesses, both in restaurants as well as the entertainment industry. And so with that, I would like to move the DE amendment to take on 2104.
And just to make sure, I can't remember if we did the, you're moving the bill, House File 2104, and then you're moving the DE1 amendment.
I am, Madam Chair.
And so all those in favor of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The amendment is adopted. And Representative Kahn to the bill as amended.
Well, I'm very pleased with the amendment from my longer experience, almost than anyone on this committee. My experience has showed that anything that starts out being called the Blue Ribbon Commission is usually worthless.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, I certainly appreciate your endorsement of not only what was, but is and has become 2104. Representative Kahn and Madam Chair, with your indulgence, I do have one testifier to this bill. If
please.
Would be willing to hear?
Yep, if you would. Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record.
Absolutely. Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Andrew Johnson. I am a Minneapolis City Council member from Ward 12, and I represent a little more than 30,000 constituents and several hundred businesses. I'm very glad for Representative Albright's work on amending this and Representative Wagenius's leadership and Drazkowski's leadership on the original item that is now incorporated into this. Basically, for those that don't know about SAC fees, these are sewer access charge fees. They're one-time fees that are imposed on businesses by the Met Council and especially affect our restaurants, our bars, our coffee shops. In terms of how much these fees are, they're the single largest fee often imposed by government on these businesses. We had at the subcommittee and committee last week that heard this measure a number of businesses that came in and testified to literally the tens of thousands of dollars that they get charged in SAC fees. Now, of course, this particular amendment is not about SAC fees overall. It is about outdoor seating and patios. And why that is important is that there are a number of small businesses that we have heard from that want to put out sidewalk seating. They want to put out picnic tables or patio space for their customers, for the benefits of the customers and the community, and for the benefits of the business. But they ultimately do not make that economic decision to do so because they face charges of thousands of dollars to literally put out a picnic table or some sidewalk seating. And in economics, that is what's called a dead weight loss, where when somebody makes that kind of an economic decision because of a very burdensome fee, ultimately the Met Council loses out on their revenue. The business loses out, the community loses out, and the customers lose out. Ultimately, everyone loses out. Everyone's a loser in that kind of a situation. Now, the SAC fees are based off of this idea that individuals coming in, if they put outdoor seating, more individuals are going to come into the business and sit down there, and they're going to end up using the toilet and flushing the toilet more, putting more of a burden onto the sewer system. But the fact is, for these small business owners, 99% of their customers are coming from the neighborhood. They're either going to be flushing the toilets at home or they're going to be flushing the toilets at the business. But overall, there's not a net increase of actual capacity on the system. In fact, Met Council said basically as much when they were testifying on this at subcommittee, that ultimately it's the days that it rains when people are not out on patios, which really maxes out the capacity of the system, not individuals going to sit outside and enjoy their coffee or their beer or their sandwich. And in fact, from business owners as well, we've heard time and time again, and granted there are exceptions to the rule, but we've heard from business owners that they see their customers actually sitting outside rather than inside. So they're not having an overall increase in customers. Now, today we could have had a lot of small business owners here, but I appreciate the committee's time, so I'll wrap up in just saying the city of Minneapolis supports this. It is a metro-wide issue, though, that is affecting our small businesses. These SAC fees are stifling growth in our city. The state's losing out on sales tax revenue, and business owners are making this decision either not to open up because of SAC fees, or not to expand, or not to even put out sidewalk seating. So this is a great bill, a great amendment. I appreciate the support that this has received so far, and I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Okay. Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to speak to this bill? Welcome. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you. Yes. Madam Chair and members, my name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. We represent 91 cities in the metropolitan area, both at the legislature and Metropolitan Council. And I do want to just, first of all, acknowledge the concerns that have been brought forth by restaurants with outdoor seating capacity. Metro Cities has often dealt with issues from a variety of cities on the SAC charge with any number of concerns over the years. Nobody really likes to pay SAC, generally speaking. With that said, would like to very much acknowledge the concerns. The preference that Metro Cities would have would be to take a look at this issue with other cities in the region and other stakeholders from the business sector and the Metropolitan Council, and to try to have an examination of this issue to see whether the criteria for outdoor seating should be modified. The position of the organization is that any exemptions or subsidies for SAC for any particular use end up falling on other sectors of either businesses or residences. And so we would want to take a look to see about how the rationale for the SAC criteria for outdoor seating should be structured. So to that end, we would recommend that this not be done statutorily, but rather with the stakeholders and cities from across the region taking a look at this issue with the Metropolitan Council. This would be consistent with how Metro Cities has dealt with this issue with the Met Council over the years. We've looked at any number of issues on the criteria for SAC, including outdoor seating, including redevelopment credits, principles for SAC, daycare centers, a variety of uses. And again, we would prefer that there not be legislative precedents set for exemptions, but rather that these be addressed with technical staff, with cities from across the region, and with businesses and other stakeholders so that we can get a handle on the criteria in a more detailed fashion. Mm. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
And Ms. Nauman, can you kind of walk me through the history, if you would, on how we got to this point, why outdoor seating and so forth? Are you able to share that, or do we have some folks here that would be able to share that?
I'm going to let the Metropolitan Council staff do that. What I will say is that this issue has been examined in the past through a structure, but I believe Mr. Shetland can discuss that with
That's
the committee.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Shetland, welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Judd Shetland. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council, so thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning. Madam Chair, to speak to your question about the history relating to SAC and the outdoor seating, back in 2009 there was a stakeholder group made up of many mayors and representatives of cities across the region that looked at this issue. In Minneapolis we had Councilmember Sandy Colvin Roy. In the city of Prior Lake we had the city administrator Frank Boyles. The mayor of Roseville at the time, Dan Bowe, Mike Gamachi, and I'm probably spelling that or pronouncing that wrong, from the mayor of Andover, Terry Schneider, the mayor of Minnetonka, as well as some council members that participated, and then our finance director from our wastewater utility. And at that point, they came back and made a recommendation to the council that they reduce the SAC charge for outdoor seating by 50%. And that then council actually reduced it to 75%. So just to clarify some of the comments that were made earlier today, those restaurants and businesses that have that outdoor seating currently pay a 75% reduction today. And so what we are asking is to reconvene that group or a similar group of regional stakeholders to come back and take another look. Since that happened in 2009, we have some time to come back and see if that 25% actually is something that we would be able to waive, or if there actually is a true cost. And based on our analysis, we believe that there is a cost, but we're willing to go back and take a look at that. And I've talked to Representative Wagenius, Representative Albright. I actually spoke to you about this Madam Chair, last Friday morning, and so that would be how we would prefer to approach this, because it's just important to remember that this is a closed system, and the council has to move forward and make these charges. So if we create an exemption for one, it has an impact on the rest of the payers. And so it's important for any of the members here in the committee who represent a metropolitan area city, because in the end, if we are making an exemption for one city or for one business or whatever else, then all of a sudden your communities could be affected. And so what we would like to do is to take a step back and do this study again, because it is just important that all stakeholders have an opportunity to look at whether or not this will be an impact. And I think that if we could, we'd be able to move forward with the study, be able to do that here within the next few months, by the end of the year, absolutely, and come back and be able to say whether or not there is a true cost to this or not. But, Madam Chair, I have some experts here from our utility who can speak to this in more detail, but the council's position at this point is just to take that step back. We will take a look at it and come back and let folks know whether or not this is a something that should be waived entirely, because maybe it should. But we are just concerned about creating an exemption, because then all of a sudden we start looking at other exemptions and our overall SAC program becomes something that has so many exemptions that we are trying to protect that and be able to keep one program that works for everybody.
And will your next testifier, Mr. Shetton, be able to address of that you have examined whether or not this would be a higher cost situation? Have you analyzed maybe a business that went from not having outdoor seating to having outdoor seating and seeing if there was an increase in capacity? Or can you tell me more details on that, or is it you just don't know at this point?
Madam Chair and members, what I'm saying is in the study, mm-hmm. we would be able to provide that analysis and come back and say whether or not there is an offset, because the argument was made that what happens is on a sunny day, you will have folks who go to the bars, restaurants, and want to sit outside, and that there is capacity left over inside, and so there should be a no net effect. And we don't know that, so all we're asking is to reconvene the same group that recommended a 75% reduction and come back and say whether or not there is no net effect, so we'd waive it. Otherwise, we'd be able to demonstrate if there is an effect and potentially maintain the charge of where we're at. But we'd like to be able to look at that versus just going ahead and making an exemption and not being able to tell you what the analysis says one way or the other.
So, Mr. Shetton, in 2009, there wasn't an analysis done. It was just more of a gut feeling, hey, we think that we're going to reduce it by 50 to 75%.
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask my next testifier here from the council to be able to speak to that. He was the lead staff on the SAC study.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Jason Willett. I am an Assistant General Manager with the Environmental Services Division of the Council. Finance is one of the areas that I deal with, and I was the Finance Director at the time. It's actually been looked at twice. 2009, this issue came up specifically, and our technical staff did look at it and tried to figure out, you know, to the best they can, how often both inside and outside space is used, because essentially if they're all used at any time, for instance, like a stadium at halftime, when everyone's using the bathroom, you have to have pipes that stand ready to serve that maximum capacity at that point in time. So we looked at it, and the best we could figure out, the staff actually recommended a 50% discount. There was a public hearing on it. There's official information on that. There were lots of written comments from different members at the time. There was over 50 people at the public hearing, and the council decided as a policy matter to go with a 75% discount. So just to be clear, ever since 2009, outdoor space is being paying 25% of what that same seating capacity would pay inside. That's been in place since 2009. In 2013, this task force that was referenced, and this is like the fourth in this last decade that's looked at various SAC issues, looked at whether there should be policy exceptions for a number of things, because there's a lot of good causes. And restaurants, outdoor seatings, we like that. You know, there's lots of other affordable housing, daycares, others that have thought that they shouldn't have to pay for their wastewater capacity as well. And this task force of our customers basically said, don't make any exceptions. You're a utility. We can do this if we want to. The cities have the authority to make this exception. Minneapolis could do it now if they wish to. So we did not change anything in 2013. The 75% discount is still in the books. Again, this is our charge to the cities. There are 108 directly connected cities and some other building permitting authorities, like the U of M and MAC also pay SAC. And they can have their own rules and their own retail charges. So this would apply to all cities, and all we're saying, we have worked really hard in this division, particularly on this fee that's been controversial for years, to work with our customer communities, and we had a task force on small businesses at one point too, all of which is on our website, the public records, the minutes, the conclusions. The council has adopted every recommendation that's come from these task forces, with the exception of a couple things that needed statutory authority, which we haven't yet gotten done. But I mean, you know, we are trying to work with the communities. We are essentially their utility. They pay for this.
But Mr. Willett, can you walk through a little bit of what the analysis that was done in 2009 and 2013? So did you take a survey of how many days were outside worthy, if you will, in Minnesota? You know, did you examine whether it was just exchanging where the space was utilized versus inside and outside? What did your analysis do?
Madam Chair, I didn't do it personally. We had an engineering staff do it, but I can tell you roughly those were the kinds of considerations. There were a lot of people at the time that said also people are just moving from the inside to out. But there were instances where, you know, on a nice day, people go and they want to go to a restaurant where hopefully they can sit outside, but when they get there, all that outside seating is full, and so inside seating becomes full too. And if it happens on even a single day, we need to stand ready to serve that. The city pipes and the council's pipes and our treatment plants have to have the capacity so you don't have to worry when you flush about causing backups. The analysis then moved to this, well, is that capacity really as valuable as was mentioned by Mr. Johnson? Because we do still experience a lot of infiltration on wet days. That's when the risk is higher in the sewer capacity that you can have backups in the local pipes or in our pipes. That analysis was really difficult to do technically because the storm borders aren't really well recorded and it takes travel time in the pipes. They did look at all of that, but really in the end it became a policy decision that we know that the space isn't as valuable during wet weather events because the outdoor space isn't used then when we're challenged. It's very similar to Excel. Gives a saver switch benefit, you know, on some of their costs. If you allow them on the days their system is stressed, you know, they can switch your air conditioning on and off. You get a rate break all year. That's kind of the concept we were saying. The capacity that we're standing ready to serve isn't as challenged on those days, on the hot days, because we don't have that inflow and infiltration. So on that policy basis, the 50% recommendation came up. We said, we know it's something. It's really hard to figure out technically. And there was a lot of political pressure, frankly, from various, including Minneapolis. And so the council adopted a 75% discount that stays in force today. Again, on our charge to the cities, they can do what they want on the retail level charge.
Okay. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess, so looking at this bill as it sits now, you're taking the Drazkowski-Wagenius bill, which was a landmark bill, and when we heard it, that shocked a lot of people. But so you're taking that bill over, and you're getting rid of the Blue Ridge Commission and then the changes that were in 2104 to the Met Council. So that's going away and is gone. So the only what we've got with the DE amendment, we've just got the Wagenius-Drazkowski bill that we talked about earlier.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
And Representative Nelson, that is correct.
Okay.
Representative Nelson.
And I guess I this last bit of testimony prompted another question for me, and I guess there's the testifier saying that the city of Minneapolis could already do this on their own without having to come to us and do this. And I guess the question I have would have, I guess, for Councilman Johnson is, why hasn't the city of Minneapolis taken that step? They can do it without us having to pass the bill. Why are you here?
Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Nelson, I think what he was suggesting is that the city of Minneapolis uses property taxes to pay for SAC fee charges, so that way there are none assessed to the city. It is actually something we looked at. My understanding from the city attorney's office is that there are actually legal challenges and difficulties with doing that, because essentially you're taking a service that Met Council says is for this business, and then you're trying to shift it onto the tax base and have somebody else ultimately subsidize and pay for that. So that is my understanding from the city attorney's office. I did talk with the city attorney about it and with our public works department. As much as I would not like to raise the city of Minneapolis's taxes by millions of dollars, personally, I think that these are so egregious. These SAC fees are so egregious and stifle so much growth across the entire metro that I would be willing to entertain that of actually raising property taxes in order to offset these. But again, my understanding is legally we cannot do that.
Representative Nelson.
So, Madam Chair, what I'm hearing here is he doesn't want to raise the taxes and spread the cost of this from these businesses to the Minneapolis tax base. He wants to take these charges and spread them across the whole metropolitan area so that everybody else can pay for somebody else's SAC fees. The ultimate shifting of cost to somebody else that he doesn't represent or that the city of Minneapolis doesn't represent. Okay, I guess that's, I can understand the bill now.
Mr. Johnson, does the city of Minneapolis charge a higher fee than what the Met Council is asking for from the businesses or not?
Madam Chair, no, it does not. And would I be able to address that?
You may, yep.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson, that is actually not correct whatsoever. What I am suggesting, I was willing to raise Minneapolis property taxes and explore that for subsidizing Minneapolis businesses, not spreading it out across the metro. This is a metro-wide issue, though, that does affect businesses across the metro. So this bill that you're hearing and the language you're hearing today would actually benefit businesses and communities across the metro. Now, if Minneapolis decided, hey, we could legally, if we found a way to legally pay for these SAC fees for Minneapolis-only businesses so that they weren't so burdened by this, then obviously that would be something we could consider doing, and I would be interested in exploring. And then, that would ultimately have the added benefit of having more growth in the city, stronger communities where we actually have active street corners and such. And frankly, at the end of the day, I think that we're talking about why can't, and again, we didn't have a lot of business, or we didn't have any businesses here today. They showed up at the past committees, and you've seen this article that was handed out that was written just yesterday in City Pages about this issue. Why can't Marla's Caribbean, for instance, just put out a picnic table outside? We've seen this issue time and again with all these businesses, and frankly, it's just a ridiculous, burdensome fee.
Madam Chair.
Representative Nelson, Representative Albright?
Madam Chair, I would draw the committee's attention to page 2 of the amendment on lines 2.16 through 2.23, and just identify that what we are talking about here is a recognition that SAC fees on a local government unit would be applicable for existing eating and drinking establishments, and any changes to those would be for increases in the number of fixtures which flush, discharge into the sanitary sewer system. So what we're talking about is increases in the growth of businesses already in established communities who wish to increase their sanitary sewer usage, not to put out three small tables and six chairs to attract newer businesses, which would and generate additional revenue for the business, and also generate additional tax revenue for the community or the municipality for which they belong. This is not an exemption. This is a provision that allows businesses to grow, and I might add, does not prohibit the Met Council from going forward with their study in any way, shape, or form to address the issues that you've heard from both the representatives of the Met Council or from Metro Cities. It does not preclude or prohibit them from taking under consideration any modifications to the SAC charges. What we're here today is to give opportunity for businesses to grow without impediment from the SAC charges. Thank you.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm just trying to understand this. There's been continued reference to putting seating out on sidewalks, and I'm just trying to see how this works. I've got one restaurant in my district that comes to mind that does put tables out on a sidewalk. There's another restaurant in my district that you have to enter the restaurant, and then they have an attached deck with a canopy over it for the sun and all of that, but you go through the restaurant and onto the deck. Now, is that considered outside seating relative to the SAC charges or not when it's permanently attached? Closed in the winter, obviously, but you go through the restaurant and then they seat you just like they would in the restaurant when you go out onto the deck.
Mr. Willett, do you want to?
Oh. Is it?
Mr. Willett.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. There are detailed rules on what constitutes outdoor space that gets the 75%. Generally speaking, a permanent cover like that would probably not qualify. I was going to try and quickly find the words, but there's a difference because if it could be used during a rain event and might still be used, we have not acknowledged that.
Representative Carlson.
It
wouldn't get the discount.
Yeah, apparently that in answering the question, at least at this point, there are differences relative to a deck possibly, depending on whether you're out in or out of the rain, and as opposed to sidewalk. So that was what I was asking. There's rules that cover that one way or the other. Thank you.
That's correct.
So, Mr. Willett, so you're saying, I think the butcher and the boar, they have coverings. You're saying that even though month of January, it's freezing outside, that they are still paying the 100% fee versus 25% fee?
Madam Chair, there are a number of rules, and I haven't found them right this minute, but if you can get out there and it's covered, generally, yes, the answer to that is yes. Remember that the SAC fee, the technical basis, is the maximum day that we have to stand ready for. So despite the fact that no one would use that during the winter, on a nice day, it will all be used. And so that capacity is something we want to pay for. I would like to point out that we have borrowed the money and built this capacity in advance. We have $1.3 billion outstanding. And this law requires us to charge other businesses and new growth. So it's not saving anybody's money. It's just shifting it to others. And if I could, one other clarification. The council wasn't suggesting to Minneapolis how they would pay our fee. There are other methods besides property taxes if they wanted to use their own authority. For instance, they have less generous credits that they give to businesses than we give to cities. So they really have other mechanisms that they could use to accomplish the city's interests.
Okay. Representative Johnson, or Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, going back to that deck, just so I'm understanding this now, if you were to use a bathroom facility, you have to go back into the restaurant, whether it's shining or raining or whatever is happening on the outside. You go back into the restaurant to use the bathroom facilities under any circumstance, because that's the only way you get in or out to the or on or off the deck. But maybe I can pursue this later. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Councilmember Johnson, has the City of St. Paul weighed in on this at all regarding this issue?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, I can tell you informally I have talked with several council members over in St. Paul, and
They agree that SAC fees are essentially the bane of their existence and a huge burden for businesses. So not on this specific legislation. I didn't reach out to them on this specific bill, but I have talked with them about the need ultimately to get rid of SAC fees at some point. I understand that Met Council needs revenue to maintain the sewer system, but right now they're shifting it so heavily onto our businesses' shoulders that it comes with consequences where there is a much larger cost from businesses not opening, not expanding, not growing. I've literally had businesses not open because of these fees. In fact, I can think of one in my ward, $1.5 million restaurant that was planning to open, and SAC fees ultimately tipped the scales enough that they walked away. That's it. One, just one restaurant. I can think of multiple.
Mr. Johnson. Okay. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to expand the questioning a little broader, just for whoever can answer. Has the SAC system always been a closed system since its inception?
Mr. Willett.
Madam Chair, Representative Runbeck, 43 years old, 1973 was the start of the SAC system that replaced a lump sum charging system to the local governments. And yes, it has had a definition of what we are supposed to pay for, and we have to charge all new capacity. So to the extent that anybody gets a break, others have to pay more.
Well, Madam Chair and Mr. Willett, so my understanding of how that works is you take the whole amount of the budget, the whole amount of the expenditures, and just divide it by all the people who pay in. And I wonder if we've had a study of what all costs are being put into that. I mean, to me, that doesn't get you any assurance that there's any efficiency going on, that there's any sort of better methods. I mean, if the budget's never been studied, it seems to me it's really time to take a look at it because, you know, the users aren't getting the benefit of having any transparency in how the money is, you know, gathered and how it's used.
Mr. Willett?
Madam Chair, Representative Runbeck, SAC by law is only used for a portion of our debt service. So we have the $1.3 billion outstanding that I mentioned, and we pay about a third of that with SAC. None of the other operating costs. We do spend a lot of time on the volume charge to the cities, which is a much bigger number, and we have, and I'd be happy to come to your office and tell you at length about our efforts at efficiency and show you where you can find our budget on the website. But that's really a separate matter. The volume charge is if the restaurant only uses the space one time a year, they're only getting charged for that volume. This is about capacity and the debt service that we've incurred to pay for that.
Representative Rumpf.
Well, Madam Chair, I mean, it does, I think, beg the question of the budget, and to take a much closer look at it would be really important, I think. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess this goes to the question that Representative Runbeck raised, is that if we pass this bill and put this into statute, it basically precludes them from having to do a study to find out if this is the right way to do it, if this is the proper way to go about it. Because now we've already got it in statute, so we've already decided what that's going to happen. It's kind of like what 2104, when it came through GovOps, when they put the Blue Ribbon Commission and then they amended into it the changes of the Met Council. We're going to predetermine, we're going to have a Blue Ribbon Commission, but we're going to put in the same bill precluding or deciding ahead of time exactly how we want the Blue Ribbon Commission to come out by passing this bill. We've already decided that, and there's no reason for them to go back and look at do a study to find out if this is the right way to do it because it's already been done to them. So with that, Madam Chair, I think this is, I have to vote against this bill.
Well, Representative Nelson and Representative Albright, you've got the last word. I understand that the version of this bill in the Senate was just introduced yesterday. I think there's probably some time to work through some of the issues that were expressed here today. I do have some concerns. To me, I would like to see greater analysis done, quite honestly, of why the fees are what they are and how they're determined, because you're not going to be able to use an outdoor space in January. Sorry, there's nobody that's going to sit out there, so whether it's covered or not. So, I mean, it just raises some bigger issues, I think, that members have all expressed here today. With that, Representative Albright renews his motion. That, unless you have final words, final comments?
No, Madam Chair, thank you for the conversation.
Okay. Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 2104, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
All right. The bill moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Representative Howe.
I have no idea what that shift is going to be.
Representative Howe moves House File 2810. Representative Howe, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, 2810 is a bill to streamline the process for police and firefighter families to receive benefits when they are killed in the line of duty. The current process in the state of Minnesota requires the grieving families to meet three different standards: PRA, Department of Public Safety, and the federal standard. This has caused confusion and delays in receiving benefits, and sometimes up to 5 years. This bill does the following. One, it provides the family an access to apply to the Commissioner of Public Safety. If the Commissioner determines that the line of death is a killed in line of death, PRA pays the appropriate benefits. It provides the federal conformity with the current federal Hometowns Heroes Act. It provides line of duty death benefits to those that die within 24 hours of responding to an incident of a heart attack, stroke, or vascular rupture. And three, it eliminates the catch-22 that families find themselves in when they qualify for federal benefits, but the state denies them due to the different standards that we currently have. The federal standard requires a local agency determination of line of duty in order to receive the death benefits. And, Madam Chair, I do have testifiers here, but I would prefer that if we can just move on, unless anyone has any questions, they're here for technical expertise if we need it.
And Representative Howe, you have the A3 amendment?
Yes, I would prefer to move. It's a technical amendment to basically just changes the line of reference to the specific paragraph of what needs to be. So I would like to move that amendment.
Okay, members, you have that A3 amendment was handed out here just in committee. We're going to get the bill in the order that the author wishes. All those in favor of the A3 amendment as moved by Representative Howe, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The A3 amendment is adopted. To the bill, is there anyone wishing to speak from the audience to this bill? Members, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Howe, is there a definition of public safety officer? Is that in statute?
That is in statute. We're not changing that definition. Okay.
Thank you. Representative Johnson. And members, we're still kind of waiting, I think, on a fiscal proponent to this. And Ms. Roberts, I don't know if you wish to speak to that at all.
Madam Chair and members, there was an original fiscal note done on this by the Department of Public Safety that estimated a cost. I believe it was of $260,000 per year. And my understanding is that amount is something that is paid for out of the department's budget in the Transportation Committee, but there's an appropriation in the Transportation Bill. And it may not be enough to cover this, the cost of this. So we're waiting for the final fiscal note.
Okay, Representative Howe, to that.
Madam Chair, I spoke to the Commissioner of Public Safety. We corresponded an email this morning. We spoke last night. Pure estimation on their part. They have no real historical data to tell us that it's going to increase or not. It was they are in arrears right now into that fund because of the climate that our current
place is where we've had more police officers shot than normal, and that's a bad status for our city, but for our state. But that is, they believe that this may contribute, but there's no data there to actually say that this is going to increase. And in the past, they've been paying these already. So I don't see that this is an increase. It's just kind of formulating the and actually putting in statute what's currently kind of being already done.
Okay. Members, any questions? All right, Representative Howe removes his motion that House File 2810 be moved to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The bill moves to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative, as amended. All right. Do you think you can do it in 2 minutes? Representative Detmer moves House File 2867. Okay. We still have Pintos. Okay. We do have just one more bill left after this. If we don't get to it, we will do it tomorrow. Okay. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 2342. And where are we going with this, Madam Chair?
This needs to go to Rules.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. As we know, as I announced before, on October 4th through the 8th, we will be hosting, the Twin Cities will be hosting the Medal of Honor Convention. And about a month, or actually that last session, Mr. John Kramer, who is part of the Minnesota Medal of Honor Memorial, came to me with some legislation, and this is what I'm going forward with. The CAP board unanimously approved the Medal of Honor Memorial proposed on their February 19th meeting, and on March 1st, the CAP staff went out, sent out a request for bids, or excuse me, a request for quotes from a design teams, and on April 1st I attended the CAP board meeting, and they selected three different companies to submit bids and designs, and there will also be a time during the groundbreaking ceremony at the memorial site during the week of the Medal of Honor convention. They plan on having a groundbreaking ceremony sometime during October 4th through the 18th, 2016. And with that, I have a testifier here, Mr. Paul Mandel from the CAP Board.
Mr. Mandel.
Madam Chair, Paul Mandel, Executive Secretary for the Capital Area Architectural and Planning Board. There are 72 recognized recipients of the Medal of Honor for the state of Minnesota. This is attributed. We do have a plaque that acknowledges 56 out in the Court of Honor, but the national group that is hosting the convention has corrected that number to 72. Most recent one, we have one living member who now resides in Florida. He was awarded the Medal of Honor in 1969 as a result of the Vietnam War. We have the three design teams out. We'll be getting design concepts back on August 15th, and then they'll be using that as a fundraising tool to raise The design is for those of you who are familiar with the pool at the Court of Honor, down underneath the building. It hasn't worked for about 10 years. It has the flower with the woman rising from, and it's called the Promise of Youth. It was restored in 1997, but shortly thereafter it started leaking. So our design criteria would be that there would be a new kind of reduced size water feature. The statue would remain because that was part of the dedication when the building went in as a tribute to the returning vet from World War I and II. And from there, it would add memorialization of these 72 members. There were six character, patriotism, courage, sacrifice,
citizenship,
integrity, and commitment. There is a statewide program going on. There's already 50 schools, and they're working to get this into all the school programs in some kind of a curriculum, either before or after the convention, because these are characteristics that are not just of the people who have died in their service, but obviously good citizens. Students should emulate these characteristics, et cetera. So these characteristics would be very prominent in the memorial, as well as some kind of a water feature. We're not thinking of a deep pool anymore. We're thinking more this higher technology today, where it's more recycling water that doesn't have the problems of standing water, where someone could have an accident and during the winter, during 5 months of the year, it looks empty. But we'll be getting design concepts in August, and then we execute contracts with the design team only after all the funds are raised. And by our policy, we require 20% of the construction for maintenance dedicated fund. I did share with Representative Detmer, and I shared with the previous committee that wasn't a finance committee. In the past, with the exception of one memorial, we've always had seed money from the state, and I know that the committee's got targets, but we've always had an infusion of some money. And I had mentioned before, we'd had always roughly $150,000. The project looks to be somewhere between $500,000 and $650,000. But I just wanted to advise you that in the past, the state has always contributed toward this to help generate some seed money.
Well, thank you, Mr.
With that, I stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Mandel. Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to speak to this bill? Members, are there any questions? Representative Detmer, I think we've got Chair Davids ready to take over the room. So Representative Detmer renews his motion that House File 2342 go to the Committee on Rules. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The bill goes to Rules.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Members, with that, we are adjourned.